All right, delighted to be joined by Sid Lowe of the Spanish Football Podcast, but also one of the great writers for The Guardian, obviously covers Spanish football. You're here in Dublin, obviously, for the for your podcast, live show with Phil Kittrell-Melides. But just before we get into maybe the topic of Basque football, which is what I wanted to chat to you about, how do you find, like, you know, presenting the pod in front of a live audience in comparison to the intimate way you normally do it, where you basically can record anywhere?
Yeah, as an experience, it's completely different, of course. You know, three men in a Skoda is kind of different to three men in a big theatre. And also, I think the other thing is that certainly preparing for this show, we were quite conscious that what we didn't want to do was just turn up and record a podcast and effectively do a podcast, but just with people in attendance. We decided, we were very conscious that we wanted it to be kind of a show. So the last time we were in Ireland, we did a show about kind of 21st century legends. So we showed some clips, we talked about it, we argued about who our perfect 11 would be. This time we decided that we wanted to do something different, not least because we released that, so everyone has seen it, so we wanted to do something new. So we were trying to find a mechanism through which we could effectively, from our point of view at least, kind of tell everyone everything they ever wanted to know about Spanish football, but maybe hadn't asked or hadn't occurred to them. So trying to take in quite a lot of history, but also some of the quirky elements of it, some of the cultural elements of it. And so we found a vehicle through which to do this, which was to do it as an A to Z, to go through the alphabet. Now, one or two of the letters are a little bit problematic. Let's just say we were struggling for a Y and for a W.
So we're obviously here at Liberty Hall. It's sunny, everything else. And as people can see, just with the good lighting, there's a lot of interesting imagery behind us. The one right behind us is the Home Rule movement, which is a nice segue into the Basque issue, because, of course, independence movements. And there is a tie-in with Ireland there as well in terms of our history. But is it fair to say, and might be too broad a stroke to say, but the Basque kind of independence movements based around the whole identity and the ethnic side in comparison to the Catalan thing, which is more cultural, linguistic, etc.? Or is that too broad a definition?
Well, it's curious because there's a word that's used a lot, and actually it's used a lot in football as well, which is raza, which means race. But it tends to refer to character and, if you like, identity on a kind of a cultural and personal sense rather than, strictly speaking, race. But, of course, there is this idea that what makes the Basque Country different and what makes it so kind of outstandingly different is that it's not just a different language, as for example Catalonia has, but it's a different language with roots that appear to make no sense in terms of its geographical location. So, for example, if you're a Spanish speaker, you can listen to Catalan and you can make sense of it and you can understand it. You maybe struggle to speak it, but you can understand it because, of course, it's a Latin language and the roots of it make sense. But Basque is such an outlier, such a linguistic outlier. There's an element of cultural, being a cultural outlier as well. There is that sense that as I say, race is not really understood, I think, in genetic terms or in racial terms as we would perhaps understand it, more in this idea that there is a character, there's a ruggedness, there's something about being forged by your land that, as I say, breaks slightly from the traditional idea of what race would be.
And as you said, the word outlier there, and in terms of football, of course, Athletic Bilbao and previously Real Sociedad would have been outliers in the sense, well, Athletic Bilbao still now, but in terms of the fact they have this policy where it is either Basque players, those of Basque origin, or those that were raised in the region. Has there been any movement to see that changed or any pressure within the region itself?
No, I think one of the most remarkable things about Athletic's kind of Basque policy, as it were, is that it's not challenged. There was a very interesting remark said recently, and Athletic have just been through presidential elections, and actually the presidential elections happened just as they were changing manager at a time when it looked like they would be in really terrible problems at the bottom of the table, a possibility of a first ever relegation. And I think it's worth underlining that fact, first ever relegation. This is one of only three teams, with the obvious two, Barcelona and Real Madrid, that have never been relegated from the first division. And even then, there was this sense that, okay, now we're going into elections, we're in trouble. Is this the time that this becomes a debate? And it was summed up brilliantly by one of the presidential or potential presidential candidates. In the end, I think he didn't stand. He said, look, you show me a presidential candidate who stands on a ticket of let's revise our policy and I'll show you a presidential candidate that loses. And I think there is no doubt from that point of view.
Yeah, the whole ruggedness as well that you kind of brought up, it just maybe takes me back to the area I wanted to touch on as well, the early 80s. So it's a remarkable period where Sociedad, or La Real maybe to give them the more proper term, win two league titles in a row. Athletic followed up with two league titles in a row. And given the fact they both had the policy at the time, it's remarkable given it's only a small pool of players. Is it a case that it was down to pretty much Javier Clemente and then Alberto Ormortea? Hopefully I pronounced that second name right. Was it down to those two men, or was there something more to it?
Well, I mean, I think there's always something more to it than managers, even managers who have an enormous impact, managers who are able to, if you like, kind of break the mould, and Clemente certainly did. I mean, bear in mind that when Athletic Bilbao win the first of those two league titles, Clemente, I think, is only 33. Mm-hmm. You know, and a manager who was very conscious of extolling, if you like, and to go back to that question of race, some of those characteristics or supposed characteristics of Basque football, very direct, very aggressive. And, you know, this is tied into all sorts of elements and looked at from a purely Spanish point of view. And there's over 1,000 kilometres between Bilbao and Seville. The pitches are different. Yeah. The climate is different. Everything that surrounds it feels different. And so there was a very clear sense of trying to, if you like, enhance those qualities or that part of their identity, rather than say, let's try and do the things that other people do. Let's try and kind of, if you like, double down on what we are. Obviously, as well, you have to look at it, I think, in a social context. But I'm always conscious of this, even as someone who I, in terms of the storytelling, in terms of the history, I'm very conscious of the symbolism of events and the social context of everything that happens. But of course, if you strip all that away, you've still got a football team that has to win a football match. And so I'm conscious of trying not to step too far. But we are talking about the early 80s, the first four titles and the beginning in the 80s. We are talking about the early 80s after Franco's died in 75. We are talking about a democracy that's coming into position and starting to consolidate, but isn't entirely consolidated. Of course, you have a military coup in 82, and you've got this situation in which you're still not sure, and you are seeing the beginnings of not the beginnings of a Basque movement, because it's already there, but the beginnings of some sense that some of those things that the Basque country had demanded are starting to come to fruition. And so there is this idea, I think, after these four league titles in a row, that this is the beginning of something new, and it will always be like this. And of course, it wasn't the case. But I think there is that sense that this was of a moment. Not, this wasn't just about two teams. It was of a moment, I think, in both cases. And as you rightly say, Real Sociedad at the time also had the Basque policy, which ends with the arrival of John Aldridge. And so I think in terms of its symbolic power, it's far greater than winning a league title. But I'm a little bit reluctant, in terms of purely of its sporting explanation, to take it too far beyond that.
And how are those teams, or that era, how is that looked on maybe in contrasting ways, I suppose, by people in the Basque region and then those outside as well? Because obviously we've all seen the YouTube video of Andoni Goicoechea basically almost snapping. Well, yes. He did snap Maradona's ankle. Yeah. And there's a sense of maybe it's a violent style of football and maybe it's too far crystallised in that moment. But is there a different, I suppose, perception of the teams from inside and outside?
It's curious, actually, because those years brought a new rivalry, which was Athletic Bilbao against Barcelona. And as you say, there's the Andoni Goicoechea breaking of Maradona's ankle. There's the quite extraordinary, and the footage is amazing, the fight on the pitch between the two teams after the Copa del Rey final between Athletic and Barcelona, to the extent that there's a moment when Diego Maradona says publicly, I would rather Real Madrid won than Athletic Bilbao. But that really was very much of a moment and a particular team. And I think it is true that from other parts of Spain, there is a sensation that, yeah, these are tough, aggressive teams. These are places you didn't want to go. They could be very, very dirty. And yet, it's also curious that despite the, if you like, the political reticence of some Spaniards towards the Basque clubs, despite the discomfort that a lot of Spaniards feel, in particular about Athletic Club, much more so than Real Sociedad, this idea that, you know, they won't let anyone play who's not Basque, and that to us is, maybe even some would express it as, that to us is racist, or that to us is a rejection of Spanishness, or a rejection of the rest of us. And yet, curiously, you strip away that element, and in footballing terms, I think there's an absolutely huge amount of respect, in particular for Athletic, but to some extent for Real Sociedad. There's a really clear sense, I think, in Spain that Basque football is different, that it has perhaps a deeper sense of its own identity, its own traditions. And in that sense, it's almost seen as more pure. So there's this great phrase that gets used a lot. And in this sense, it's almost slightly English in its approach. There's this phrase that gets used a lot, which is hard but noble. And there is this idea that there's a nobility in the violence, almost, from the Basque teams. And I genuinely think that even those people who totally reject, if you like, the political ideal of this, would look at Athletic Club and say, that's a club we admire, even if maybe not always one that they like, even though that sounds contradictory in itself.
Yeah, the relationship between the two clubs as well, La Real and Athletic, it's interesting given that I've noticed over the years Athletic have often bought a lot of players that have been brought through the La Real system. I think Inigo Martinez is the most recent, latest one. How intense is that rivalry? Because I've also heard it's quite friendly off the pitch between the fans.
It's a very curious rivalry, because this is one of those areas in which the rest of Spain looks at the Basque Country and thinks this is the way it should be, because genuinely Athletic against Real Sociedad, you will see thousands of fans in with each other. So you'll see Real Sociedad fans all over San Mamés, or you'll see Athletic Bilbao fans all over Anoeta. And so there is this sense that this is a, there's a sense that there's something bigger than just the clubs, which is almost an idea of Basque brotherhood, if you like. And there was a very famous chant when Real Sociedad, Athletic and Osasuna were all in the first division. Now Osasuna, this is a whole other question about to what extent they are a Basque team, because strictly speaking they're in Navarre and so on, but let's not get into that. Let's just accept that a lot of people in the Basque country see them as a Basque club, and a lot of Osasuna fans see themselves as a Basque club. And there was a chant then which was Ya somos tres, solo falta Alavés, which is there's already three of us, the only one that's missing is Alavés. Now as it turned out, Eibar were missing as well, but no one ever imagined that Eibar would become a first division team. And so there was this idea then that we want Alavés up with us. We want to be as many Basque teams as possible in the top division, and we support each other so long as we're not playing against each other. That said, as you rightly pointed out, there is a certain tension between Real Sociedad and Athletic Bilbao. I think it's more directed from Real Sociedad on Athletic than the other way around, which again is a reflection of power, because of course Real Sociedad were partly forced to abandon their Basque-only policy because of the economic muscle of Athletic, and there's a certain bitterness towards that. There's a certain bitterness towards what they see as the, if you like, the adoption of the identity as a club of the cantera, of the youth system of youth development from Athletic Bilbao. And they say, well, people aren't noticing us. And if you look at our first team squad, we have more homegrown players than they do. And then, as you've mentioned, with the signing of Inigo Martinez, and he's just the latest of a number of them, not a huge number, but a number of them, there is that sense of, well, yeah, but this happens because they are, if you like, the Real Madrid of the Basque Country. And therefore, there is a rejection of it. But even with that, I think there is something a little bit deeper, and there is something which says, yeah, we share more with each other than we have that splits us apart, and we share something together which the rest of Spain perhaps doesn't.
Yeah, I suppose a final question before we let you go. Of course, here and on our show as well, we've discussed the whole Bale issue as well. Of course, he doesn't speak Basque, and there's a rumour, obviously, that seems to be emanating from within the Real Madrid dressing room that his Spanish is not up to scratch. I would find that very hard to believe, given he's been there so long, and he had the basics as well. His situation, how do you see this playing out? Because it seems he's being pushed out, at least by elements either within the media or even within the club itself.
It's very difficult to know how this ends, because at the moment it doesn't have a simple solution. At the moment you look at it and you think, well, this situation is up to a point. It feels slightly unsustainable because, you know, he has certain elements, as you say, of the media and the fans against him. I think he has elements of the club against him now. The dressing room, I think one of the things that wasn't really talked about in his recent slightly angry reaction to a couple of goals he scored against Atletico first and then against Levante was this idea that, well, you know, he shrugged off his teammate Lucas Vázquez. It didn't matter that it was Lucas, he was just, if you like, the first teammate to him. But I think obviously the context of this was that he felt that he'd been publicly hung out to dry a little bit by teammates. Now, it wasn't terrible what they said, and it was Marcelo saying he doesn't speak Spanish, it was Thibaut Courtois saying he doesn't come out for dinner, he just plays golf. I think one of his other teammates pointed out that his nickname is the golfer within the dressing room. And although that's not a particularly awful thing to do, I think it does leave him a little exposed at a time when perhaps he needed some support. So there's no doubt that he was irritated by that. And I think the ideal solution now is that a way out is found for him. But this is why it's not easy to do, because what is that way out? And there are three very basic elements, I think, that make it very difficult to find a solution that involves him leaving the club. One is his age, the other is his salary, and the other is his transfer fee. And all three of those are things that discourage clubs from coming to sign him. And so I must confess, I don't know what the solution is. Obviously, the perfect scenario, and this is made more difficult by Zidane coming back, and his relationship with Zidane wasn't good, and he'd admitted that publicly, and I think he knows that. Of course, the perfect scenario is that he plays between now and then season, plays really, really well, has some sort of rapprochement with Zidane, and there's a discussion that says, you're going to be important next year, and he carries on playing, and he stays injury-free, which is another big element of this, and that he's brilliant. I mean, that's the perfect scenario for everyone. How easy it is to get to that position, I must admit I have my doubts.
We certainly will see. But Sid, thanks a million for your time, and best of luck with the podcast recording tonight as well.
Thank you.